Hello, I am Sarah, and I'm the host of Psych in the City. Today, I'm speaking to Sanaya, a fellow sex educator who I learn a lot from. In this episode, we talk about a bunch of stuff. We discuss abortion, doula work, specifically Sanaya's work of being an abortion doula, and we finish off the episode talking about Sanaya's journey with polyamory. So, Naya, they, them, aka at Ho on the Go, is a community sexual health educator, pleasure activist, Ho mentor, abortion doula, and sex toy reviewer. They strive to create easy and accessible free sex education to folks in the Black community, prioritizing liberation, decolonization, and harm reduction. Naya's goal in their work is to create a world in which sex and shame no longer coexist. A world in which speaking freely about sex and pleasure are no longer taboo. And as a non-binary, queer, polyamorous person, Naya also emphasizes uplifting and highlighting those in their marginalized communities. All of Sanaya's information and where you can find them will be in the show notes as well as at the end of the episode, in addition to where you can find me. Hello, everyone. Today, I am speaking with Sanaya, whose work I've been following on Instagram, and I learn a lot from. And Sanaya is a sexual health educator, an abortion doula, a harm reductionist, a guest writer and columnist, a brand ambassador, product reviewer, many, many things. Hello, Sanaya.
Hi, good afternoon. I was like good morning.
I know. I hope this wasn't too early for you. I'm sorry. I actually forgot to mention that.
I'll be fine.
But yeah, I'm really excited to talk to you today because you, one of the many things that you do, is an abortion doula, and which is something that I am really interested in. I've heard of before, but I don't know that much about. In addition to, we're going to be talking about a lot, but tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, what you do. What's, you know, how did you get into sex education? All the things.
Yeah. So my name's Sanaya. My pronouns are they, them. I am a, you already said all the things. I'm a lot of things. how did I get started in this? Honestly, I think life kind of just sent me in this direction. I've always been really an avid just kind of like storyteller, like what is life without stories, right? So I don't know, my friends have always just known that I've been kind of the more openly honest sexual person in the group, and then like from there it just kind of turned into this thing where I started giving everybody advice, and then I just was like, why doesn't anyone know this information? And then it's kind of like, wait a minute, this is a larger problem. So then I was like, okay, then I started kind of like digging deeper into like sexual health education and just realizing like, wow, we were really kind of duped when it came to sex ed because we really didn't get any information, if at all. It's been an interesting journey.
And so what are you doing currently? I mean, we talked a little bit about it, but like, what, you are an abortion doula, mm-hmm. in addition to many things. So how has that, I guess my first question is, can you explain a little bit about what is a doula in general? And then what is an abortion doula?
Yeah. So, a doula is a birth worker, because there's so many different types of doulas. Even abortion doulas fall under the category of birth work. And so doulas are folks who assist and aid birthing people in various aspects of their birthing journey, whether that be pre, during, post, even family care. There's like family doulas that kind of come and help the family while they're transitioning with the newborn. Like there's so many different roles that a doula can take. Abortion doulas are really interesting because there's so many different aspects of care that go into that. And it's not limited to just abortions, even though we say abortion doula. An abortion doula is someone who assists birthing people in all forms of birthing conclusion. So that could be miscarriage, or spontaneous abortion. That could be stillbirth, abortions, like we've said, and that could also be not even just, hey, I'm going to take you to the doctor. It could be, hey, I'm going to help you find funds so you can pay for your procedure. It could be assisting with emotional support, physical support, even, making sure someone has food, is staying hydrated, they've got heating pads, things like that.
So when you say under this umbrella, when you say you're an abortion doula, what are we considering an abortion? You said a spontaneous abortion, which is also called a miscarriage. Like, what are some, so what is considered abortions?
So that's interesting because it gets very political. But
How do
yeah.
you frame, like, in your work, or in the world of abortion doulas, like, what do people and the doula and birth work, like, what is abortion is just a word that can mean many different things ultimately, right?
Right, it can. And so at least in my work and in my training, abortion to me is those things that I shared, like spontaneous abortion or miscarriage, stillbirth, which is something that we wouldn't consider necessarily an abortion, right? Because someone is technically carried to term. But yeah, so stillbirth, even in the early stages of pregnancy where it might not be considered a miscarriage or a spontaneous abortion because we actually have those more often than we think. Just I'm trying to think of the specific terms that we use. It's been a while since my training, but yeah, those are the ones that we most commonly talk about and experience in the field.
So what are some of the, what training, what does training look like? Tell me a little bit about that to become a doula, an abortion doula. Like what are some of the things that has to be done?
Yeah, so I'm sure there's various programs and they all look a little different. My program was run by a really good friend of mine who's a birth worker in Los Angeles. And they actually offered a free program for folks that were in the Los Angeles area.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, so it was a 2-day, 8-hour full Zoom course. We learned literally all of the things that you wouldn't even think would come into this type of work. A good chunk of our lessons were very personal, I guess I would say. Like we talked about something that I didn't even think that we would talk about is like, okay, say you're with a client, and you're going into the hospital with them and they ask you about things that this person wants to keep, right? Like keepsakes. I would have never even thought about something like that, or even making a list of things that you need to prepare for when you're going into the hospital. Another thing that we talked about a lot was like the politics of it. Like I mentioned, right? Abortions are very political, especially right now. And we talked about the legalities and where we could possibly get in trouble depending on where we live and who we're supporting and what we're doing, even keeping our clients safe. What are the laws around abortion in their area? Safety, transportation, even access, talking about access and networking. That was a really huge part of our lesson planning was networking. Who do you know just in case you're in a space where you're not able to get access to these tools for this person to be safe or to actually get their procedures done? Yeah, just a lot of things that we wouldn't really necessarily think about in terms of abortions.
Wow.
Yeah.
What is, what are things that come up? I mean, I guess for you as an abortion doula, like what comes up for you in your work?
Something that actually came up for me very, very quickly when I first started the work was how personal it can be for yourself and for others around you. My first client was actually my best friend. And so that was one, it made me look at it in a very different way because I was like, this is someone that I actually know personally. And then it also made me reflect on my own experiences because it was also so personal. Because I'm like, okay, even though I've had my own experiences with spontaneous abortion, and if I'm helping a stranger, I can relate those things. But you're not thinking like, oh my gosh, my first client's gonna be like my best friend or a family member. It kind of changes your plans of action, I believe. And the way that you strategize things. And then it kind of changed my outlook and my entire practice. You deal with a lot of emotional things for many reasons. It's a very emotional experience from start to end. And that's not even necessarily to say that there is an end, you know? You deal with a lot of roadblocks and really kind of messed up realities when it comes to the politics and the money that comes into having types of procedures done. That was probably my biggest challenge in my work was the access and the money. We don't talk about how expensive it is actually to have an abortion, let alone the access that people have. So when you do have access, depending on where you live, you could be spending upwards of like $1,000 for this procedure because it is never covered by insurance.
Are you based out of California?
Yes, I am.
So what is, to your knowledge, so it's always out of pocket. So everybody is paying for an abortion.
It's very, very rare that they would consider it a medical emergency. And even then, you're most likely going to be paying something.
And is that sometimes included? Like, there's multiple payments because it's not just the procedure, it's like the aftercare, and it does that, is that true?
Right. Yeah, you've got your follow-ups and things like that because most, well, now because of the pandemic, they've really been pushing for at-home abortions, where folks kind of self-administer their medication and things, and it's safe. But because of, you know, just whatever possibilities with folks' health or any type of complications, that it's very hard to get into a doctor with for those types of procedures.
So is that something that you would also be present for if somebody, if a client of yours wanted to have a home abortion or take the, pill, that would something that potentially you could assist with?
Yes, if they requested.
What is considered a miscarriage?
So a miscarriage or a spontaneous abortion can happen naturally or you know, due to any other type of medical or accidental things that might happen. And it's the loss of the embryo or the fetus. Usually this is before it's able to actually like survive independently, I believe. So that's 20 up to 20 weeks. Yeah, that's up to 20 weeks. And yeah, like I said, it can happen at any time. Of course, it's considered a stillbirth once the child is a child, right? So this is one that I guess folks don't really talk about as much because it happens so often. But yeah, like I was saying, we have spontaneous abortions a lot. Sometimes when folks are menstruating and you have what seemingly is a blood clot, that actually could be a spontaneous abortion. You would not even know that.
It's, a relative of mine was pregnant and experienced, experienced a miscarriage. They had trouble getting, getting and keeping a pregnancy. And they have become so passionate about, they were like, nobody speaks about how common. And then when they started to kind of talk to friends about it, all of a sudden everyone was like, oh yeah, I had three. Oh yeah, I had multiple, like so many people. And these were people she had known for years. And it was like, oh, like this is so much more common than anybody speaks about. Because it's just something that it's like under wraps. And I think it's like kind of like people think it's shameful. People think that there's something maybe inherently wrong with their body, or just it's not discussed. And so they were just so surprised when all of a sudden they were like, oh, like this is so much more common than I could even envision.
Yes. And you're exactly right.
Yeah.
Which is why we never know how common it is.
Right.
I think my first experience with that, definitely felt a lot of shame. I was just like, whoa, like, why did that happen? Why, you know, is there something wrong with me? Did I do something wrong? Did I do something with my body? Mm. There were so many questions. And so then when I like realized like, oh, wait, like this happens more often than I'm thinking. And then, like you said, talking to people I knew, I was just like, wow, why aren't we talking about this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I imagine it includes a lot of emotional support and working through and helping people navigating all of these feelings that come up for abortions, spontaneous abortions, many of just the idea of, I mean, just the thought of like being pregnant and like pregnancy in general. So like, does a lot of your work include not helping people navigating that and guiding people or just assisting people and like talking about these, all this kind of stuff when there's not really a lot of times anywhere else to discuss it?
Oh yeah. It gets so nuanced too. Mm. It's like everyone's experience is so individualized and you know, like I said, so many things you don't think about that come up. One of the things that came up for me was, helping someone who was Catholic and them trying to make sure that, you know, their baby was okay because they were like feeling very guilty, feeling shame, feeling sinful. And I'm not someone who's religious. So I'm like, oh my gosh, how do I support this person when they're literally having like they want to have a kind of a religious conversation. And luckily there's a huge network of, abortion doulas, and I was able to get resources to help this person through that. But it's like, yeah, there's so many different feelings that come up for people, so many different thoughts that you're there for. So you're like, okay, we gotta roll with these things, because sometimes you're like, oh my gosh, I was not expecting that question.
yeah. And is that difficult for you? Is that hard?
It can be, because then it's like, okay, I really want to support someone, but I also don't want to impose my own stuff on someone else. And so I always try to be as neutral as possible, but then also support people in the way that they need to be supported. So that's why my immediate thought was like, what resources can I get for this person? Because I can't give them a direct answer, but I want to give them the best support that I can.
Mm, yeah. What are some of the things that you've learned the most, like in your doula work, in your work in general, like as a sexual health educator, a harm reductionist, all the things that you do, like what would you say have been the biggest lessons thus far?
Honestly, meeting people where they're at, like I know we say that a lot, but that has really been true in my work, because I've met people from literally age 3 to like 70. And I'm like, the conversations that we have, you would think maybe we've all had at some point in life, but no, like we're all learning, constantly learning till we're not learning anymore, right? And it's just we can't expect that people necessarily know what we know, and also just learning from others because they teach me just as much as I'm teaching them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I work as a therapist, you know, in an infectious disease clinic and outside. And it's so much, I feel like so much of the work, or it can be a huge part of it, is just like this co-healing that can happen. And just about like, even if we're not going through the same situation, even if we're completely different people, like all of these things, there's certain experiences that just are just A, so healing to witness and to be even the privilege of being a part of, and like to watch somebody and to work and to hear somebody's, like just to bear witness to somebody's journey is just, I feel like, so powerful. And so just, I mean, I imagine it's just so emotional and just so like,
there's just so many side effects of the work that I think sometimes are not, I mean, for myself, I don't take into account until I'm like hit a point and I'm like, oh, okay. I get why this is happening. But yeah, what are some of the problems, if you can speak to this, currently within California, like in regards to abortions, if you know that?
Sure. Well, right now, I'll definitely say access, which is not even just California. The United States has an access problem, partially because of politics, but right now, definitely because of COVID.
Totally.
COVID really messed stuff up. Like, all of the Planned Parenthoods were closed. You were only able to get like virtual appointments, which is why they're really pushing for the at-home abortions if you can. Even when folks are high risk, which I've had clients who are high risk, they were like, well, you'll be fine. If anything happens, go to the emergency room. So it was just like, it's very difficult and frustrating because it's like, this is not necessarily something that should be taken as lightly as it has been. And so, yeah, right now, definitely access. Things are sort of opening back up, but I think we already know we're preparing for another lockdown. So I'm concerned about that. In regards to just sexual health in general, like people were not taking care of their sexual health over this lockdown.
Yeah. And when you say that, like, are you saying that California is pushing for the, how do the at-home abortions work? Do they send you the medications? Like if they're not doing in-person appointments at all, do they send people the medications or like, how does that work?
Yeah. So, you'll probably do it. There's two ways that this could happen. You could do it through, or three, I guess. So your own provider, like if you have your own insurance, most likely what would happen is they would just, you know, send the prescription to the pharmacy and you go pick it up. Or they have a website that it's a couple websites that exist now where you can actually find places in your area that can send you the pills and then you can pay for them through that website. Or you can go to like a clinic or a Planned Parenthood and then they would send you a prescription through to a pharmacy where you would go pick up the medication.
What are some of those websites if you know offhand?
Yeah. So there's, a website called plancpill.org.
Oh yes. Yes. Yes,
they are amazing. You can literally just, click your state and put your zip code in and they'll pop up all the places where you can, get access to the medication. And they also have the pricing so you can kind of see what's more in your budget. It's a very helpful tool.
Wow. Awesome. Yeah. I've seen them on Instagram and everything. I've looked them up extensively just because I thought it was so awesome. That's cool. Yeah. Yeah. So access is huge just in general. I mean, across the United States, and then that's been exacerbated because of COVID, because so many clinics and things are closing. And so a lot of people, I mean, then that probably makes it even more difficult for people that are further along in their pregnancy who may need an in-person procedure or who may need a higher level of care than an at-home plan, I guess. So I imagine it gets more complicated.
Oh, yes. It gets very complicated. That was something that was interesting because one of the clients that I had was actually out of state and they were in a red state and they were really close to where they actually needed to go in for a procedure, but they told them to just take the pill because they weren't allowing folks to come in. And that was actually not a very good experience because they should have gone in, but because of the way that they're doing things because of COVID, they really are not necessarily pushing for people to come inside. And that's very problematic and very dangerous. But yeah, it's unfortunate, but COVID laws are trumping a lot of things right now.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate that is the case.
Can we talk a little bit about post-abortion syndrome, if you can speak to that?
Yeah. Post-abortion syndrome is...
like, what is it? Tell me what you think about it, like it, whatever you can speak to about it.
Yeah, it's like a disorder that they've said happens, which is similar to PTSD. Basically, you have like physical symptoms. you know, feelings of like guilt and anxiety and stuff, which it's honestly, it sounds very based in a little bit of like religion, because yeah. obviously those are types of feelings you would have if you like committed a sin. Mm. So like, you know, I mean, just can someone have like PTSD from having an abortion or like a spontaneous abortion? Absolutely. I think that's possible. It's a very traumatic experience. But yeah, I don't know if there's necessarily like a specific syndrome for that.
People have a lot of complicated feelings about abortions, but overwhelmingly, when a planned abortion occurs, so much the feelings are mostly positive, or like relief, or like that they were happy, that they felt that they made the right decision. It's basically, from the information that I gathered and how I feel and how it was framed to me, is that it's kind of been sensationalized, yeah. and it's used as a fear-based tactic to force people to not go through with right. an abortion, if that's what they are wanting. If what you were saying, sure, it, a lot of people can feel many different things after a procedure, after any medical, any type of procedure. Right. But because of the longstanding historical political nature of the abortion, that this was kind of sensationalized by whoever, I don't know who, that, oh, like the big fear is if you have an abortion, you will regret it and you'll forever live with this, you know, post-abortion syndrome of doubt. And like, but existing medical research basically doesn't support these claims. And that it's like that abortion itself is steeped in a lot of myths, and post-abortion syndrome is one of them. Of course, individuals can feel all types of ways, but overwhelmingly, like abortions, people don't experience this syndrome that they refer to. It's like some of the ones of like, oh, if you get an abortion, it like might increase breast cancer or can make it difficult yeah. to get pregnant in the future, and like, or carry other pregnancies to terms, where it's like all of that has medical research has completely not supported those claims because they're not real.
The academic version of a birthing center.
correct. And you know, they say it's a lot of times compared to post-traumatic stress disorder, mm-hmm. and that, you know, tearfulness, mood changes, and it's like, okay, yeah, that can happen with right. any type. And I mean, that can happen at random all the time for no reason. And like, of course it makes sense that if you're having a medical procedure in any capacity, that could potentially happen. Like people often do experience intense emotions just before and immediately after having an abortion, but there's no like long-term lasting impact on a person's like mental health if it's what they wanted. It, you know, if many people say that they made the right choice.
I kind of rambled on for a second, but ultimately, post-abortion syndrome, those who support its existence have compared it to post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, suggesting it shares many of the same symptoms. However, people, yes, often do experience emotions before or after a procedure, but experts haven't found any evidence to suggest these emotions linger or have a lasting impact on the mental health of a person. Relief was the most used word that patients use to describe their emotions long after a procedure. According to the best evidence, if you ask people who had an abortion 5 years later whether abortion was the right choice, over 99% of them will say that it was. The story that people regret their abortions is one that is mostly made up by people who are against abortion. The reference for this information is in the show notes.
I kind of want to shift gears a little bit. You also talk a lot about on your page polyamory.
Yes.
And I want to just speak to that a little bit. How long have you been practicing polyamory? Like, what is the biggest lesson? Tell me the things.
Sure. So it's actually really funny. Like, more than I talk about it now, I'm like, I've always been polyamorous, even in my like high school dating phases, but I just didn't have the words for it. And I don't think, of course, my peers necessarily knew what that was. So it just a little messy, but I was being open and honest, but yeah. So yeah, I've been practicing polyamory in my adult life, basically since I was like 18. I've always kind of had multiple partners at once. I was always very honest, like, hey, I'm seeing these other people. And like, it was never a secret. Of course, I had situations and relationships that were monogamous at some times, but I'd probably say maybe once I turned like 21, that I was very much like, okay, I'm a polyamorous person. And I'm not necessarily gonna go into a monogamous relationship.
Right. Like, so it was like all you were out there.
Yeah.
Got it. What type of polyamory do you practice, and if you could explain that for us a little bit?
Yeah. So I am solo polyamorous person, which means that I am my own primary partner. I like date myself. I put myself first. But I also practice like relationship anarchy, which is essentially that all of my relationships are on like a linear playing field, and there's no one relationship that's higher than the other.
So no like primary partner.
Right.
Got it.
All of my partners currently have other partners anyway. So the way that it works out is kind of easy. But when I was in a serious partnership, it was a little bit different. You know, you got to kind of maneuver a little differently when you're practicing relationship anarchy. It's a little different, but yeah, I've always been a firm advocate and like giving the same level of attention and care to all of my partners and relationships, whether that be romantic, sexual, friends, whatever.
Does that mean that in a romantic capacity you only date people who are also relationship anarchists, or can one of your partners potentially have a primary partner? How does that look for you?
It seems to be that I've maybe gotten lucky and all of my partners are kind of like that. So,
like relationship anarchists.
Yeah. But I wouldn't mind if they had like primary partners and stuff. It actually makes it easier for me, because then I'm like, well, that person's got, you know, other people to see and other things to do. So it's like, I'm not necessarily too worried about maybe putting too much attention over here or something like that, where I'm like worried about splitting my time.
So I think a big myth I've heard people say, or even in my less, you know, less mature years, I've been like, oh, I'm too jealous. You know, I'm too jealous. I could never, you know, and talk to me about jealousy. I think there's a myth that people that are polyamorous don't experience jealousy. Mm-hmm. Like, tell me a little bit, like, how do you navigate your jealousy? What has helped you? Like, tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah. Yeah, you're definitely right. It's a very common myth that everybody thinks that polyamorous people don't get jealous. And I think it's really funny, because I'm like, we all get jealous in any situation, not even just relationships. Like,
oh yeah, friends
or your siblings, or, you know,
yeah.
So yeah, I'm like, of course we get jealous. I think now that I'm older, for sure, I realized that a lot of my jealousy wasn't really jealousy. It was more kind of just like FOMO. And I'm just like, wow, y'all are doing cool stuff. I want to go do cool stuff with you too. But I understand that this is time for like these two people, so I'm not going to be in their business. But yeah, it's definitely, my mindset has shifted. And I've realized that like my jealousy was actually something else. Yeah, that's something that I think we don't really think is, like, we think jealousy is the issue, but it's actually like something underneath that's really causing you to feel jealous.
So you've just, in a way, dug a little deeper into your perceived jealousy about like what's actually coming up for me right now. Why is it coming up? What am I, you know, you've kind of investigated it a little more.
Yeah.
But do you feel that you, like, is it always something else for you?
Not necessarily. Sometimes it's just like, oh, there's this new person that's around. And I think you get just like a little teeny feeling of like insecurity. but it's never long, I should say. Like, it's never like, oh my gosh, I feel jealous for like weeks on end or something like that. It's usually kind of like an initial feeling, and then you kind of talk it out or you work it out with yourself, and then you're like, oh, okay, that was kind of silly. I wasn't even really like tripping over too much. Like, it was just a thing that I was kind of consuming my mind, and you end up feeling like, okay, maybe I'm actually just focusing on this thing that it's, and I need to distract myself. I think we also like hyper focus on stuff, and that's what kind of makes us jealous.
How did you learn to stop comparing yourself to partners in polyamory, or have you never done that? And if so, tell me your ways.
I think there's always gonna be like this teeny thought in the back of anyone's mind of like, okay, what is it that my partner or this person sees in this other person? And what's fun and cool about polyamory is that sometimes, not always, because some people are not into like meeting their metamors. Sometimes you can meet these people and be like, okay, I met this person, I spent time with them, I see what my partner sees in them, and that's awesome. And then that's when you experience like compersion and you're like, oh my God, I love this for them. Or sometimes you'll meet them and be like, okay, I might not see it, but I love seeing my partner happy, which makes me happy. So there's that too.
But so is it, well, first of all, can you just define for us compersion and a metamor?
Yeah, so metamor is your partner's partner. And compersion is kind of the feeling of happiness that you get from experiencing your other person's happiness. So you can experience compersion with your friends, your family, like just being happy for someone else. It doesn't have to necessarily be in a romantic sense.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. So you can experience compersion. It's not just in a romantic context. It's in,
not at all.
Even if it's in anything.
Yeah.
Oh, fun. But so yes. What has been your biggest like personal success in like your polyamory journey or just in the way you approach your relationships romantically?
Definitely being good and firm and setting boundaries. And that's like, I'm not ashamed to say that it took me a while to do that, because you got to go through some stuff to kind of learn like what works and doesn't work. And I finally feel like I've gotten to a really good place where I'm like really good at sticking to my boundaries and setting them and like letting people know like, hey, you got to stay over there.
Yeah. And was that trial and error, a lot of it?
Oh yeah, definitely. I think it's really easy, especially in polyamory, to just like want to give a lot of love and space, and you can really easily kind of like lose your own sense of self, like because you're just like you're maintaining multiple relationships. And so you got to be really good at making sure you've got a good sense of self and maintaining your own relationship with yourself. I got a lot better at that. And being clear with people about like my own personal boundaries and then my relationship boundaries.
Wow. And how did you, I guess, you know, like, when did it become clear to you that you were like, okay, I need to start being better about my boundaries because I am losing like my sense of self? Was there just a few signs that finally came up for you and you were like, okay, this is because I'm not doing X, Y, and Z or with my boundaries? Like, was it just a learning process?
Yes. At the beginning of this year, I got out of a toxic partnership with my then life partner.
Oh, wow.
Yes. We worked together for 3 years and there were just a lot of things that were not working. We were polyamorous, we were dating other people, and it was fine. But I think that because of my personality, I'm very kind of like go with the flow and just like relaxed. And sometimes that works, but it doesn't work for everybody. And so it became very apparent that it was being taken advantage of. And so I was like, all right, I can still be this like go with the flow person, but I can also have healthy boundaries for my own safety.
Oh, I totally relate. Sometimes I feel like I'm very like
oh, like I'm go with the flow person. Like I don't, you know, it's fine. Don't worry about it. But it's like, yeah, you can still be go with the flow person in addition to having boundaries. It doesn't have to be one or the other. And therefore you're not go with the flow person because you have boundaries. They're not either or.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And that took me a little bit of time to figure out, but
it's lifelong. I mean, for me, it's been like completely lifelong. Like I mean, cause I don't know why it's like this thing in my head where, and I know that it's not, you know, now that I'm older, I know that it's not the way, but it still feels like the way. It's like, oh no, like if I'm just like, I'm like chill girl, you know, like I'm like totally fine with like anything. And it's like, but you're actually not. And pretending that that's not true. And pretending that I am actually leads me to long-term discomfort rather than addressing the, you know, short-term discomfort of just like setting this boundary and actually just honoring what I'm feeling, you know? Well, so what has changed for you when you first were practicing polyamory versus now?
Yeah, definitely. How I was like dating has changed for sure. Back then I was dating much more casually. Didn't necessarily have an intention. Like, it was just like, yeah, like I'm just meeting all these people, which I love because I just love people. But I also was like, what am I kind of doing? Like, I was just kind of like, not necessarily shooting it just out into the air, but it was just kind of like, whoever is around and it is what it is. I'm very intentional now. In all aspects, whether it be friendship, romantic, sexual, definitely still open to like the casualness of things, but it's definitely more geared with intention, not necessarily with an end goal in mind, but it leaves space for things to just naturally happen.
And I feel like sometimes people confuse being polyamorous with like, oh, you only date casually.
Yes.
And that's not... and I think that's another, you know, that's a myth about polyamory is that, oh, if you're polyamorous and you have multiple partners, that means they're all casual partners and you quote unquote can't commit.
Right. I was like, no, they're all commitments.
Yeah. This is so much commitment. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, that is like when people are like, you're not committing. I'm like, no, people who are polyamorous are committing time and energy and money. And just like, there's so much that goes into it. Like there's most of polyamory is scheduling. I just want everybody to know that. Like
seriously.
Time together, FaceTime calls, you know, date nights. Like it's literally just a big scheduling time.
And a lot of like organization, like planning and like intention, what you were saying. And I think for you, you know, with being a relationship anarchist, you want to give everybody equal time, I imagine, like equal commitment. So it's like, that's even more of, I think, an intention.
Yes. And just also being honest with people about like capacity, which I don't think a lot of people ever are, and they should be. It's like, hey, if you feel like you're not going to be able to give whatever amount of energy towards this thing, you don't have to try to do that or lie about it. Just be like, hey, I'm not able to do this. And then guess what? Because we're polyamorous, we could just switch up our relationship and take a step back, or we could, you know, move forward. And it like doesn't have to be weird because relationships can change and flow over time.
So is that something that occurs when you are dating somebody? Is that a conversation that you have? Is like, hey, you know, what is your capacity level? Like what will this look like for us? Or tell me a little bit more about that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. My favorite thing to do with people is check-ins. Like, are we not even just like to see if things are like solid, just be like, hey, like, where are you at? How are you doing? Because, you know, life is life. And yeah. It's, we have to be honest with each other. But yeah, I will fully be like, you know, I noticed that this seems this way. How are you feeling about it? Is it just me, or am I, you know, reading things differently? Like, I don't want to ever waste anyone's time because it's precious. So it's like, why not just have a conversation and be honest about it?
Totally. Yeah. What it might, two final questions.
Sure.
What is your favorite toy right now?
Ooh. Well, I just got a toy from this company that I'm a brand ambassador for, Ioba Toys. They just made one called the Oh My C, and it's kind of like egg shaped, and it's supposed to be like a clit stimulation, oral sex simulator.
Okay.
It's got like a little massage ball on it, and it like rotates. It's got three speeds. It's awesome.
Oh, so that's the new, what is it called?
The Oh My C from Ioba Toys.
My C from Ioba. Yeah. Nice. Okay. And then what has been, you know, in your being a sexual health educator, abortion doula, harm reductionist, you know, your own personal life, like, and your own life in general, like, what has been, I guess, what has been the biggest lesson for you? And then what do you hope to see moving forward for like your work, but just in general, from like sexuality, the sexuality field in general?
Yeah. I think my biggest lesson has been that we really just need to be so much kinder to each other. Like,
yes,
we doing all this work because I'm a community sexual health educator because I literally do all things like abortion doula. I was an HIV tester, and counselor for a while, you know, working in nonprofit, doing harm reduction with substances, like all of those things are one, they all intersect in some way, shape or form. And two, yeah, we just need to be so much kinder to people. Like, we're all out here living life, and sometimes it just looks a little different for us. And I think we just need to be more understanding about that.
Totally.
And then, yeah, for sexual health, the future, I really hope that we can continue to normalize this and like talk about it and not be so ashamed of like the fact that we're sexual beings. Because at the end of the day, sexual health is just health. It's our part of our general well-being, and we need to treat it like such. I think we have like really accepted and normalized mental health. And so I'm hoping that we can continue to do that with sexual health.
Totally. What are your plans or what are your goals for your career or your sexuality educator journey life?
Yeah, I'm like, I don't know exactly what to call it, but I feel like I continued on this like sexual expansion where it's like, right now, one of the things that I'm kind of tapping into is like photography for sex workers and videography, because one, there's not a lot of femme beings or non-binary folks that are doing that. And it's a space where it can be very kind of like predatory or unsafe. And so I've been thinking about like the ethical background and stuff of like sex work and like ways that I can make that safe for people that I know, especially like a lot of my friends who do sex work. And so, yeah, I just want to like continue to create this like safe space for people and keep having these conversations to normalize these things. Cause I'm like, this is just literally like, it's life. Like we're all out here living and we just got to do better.
Totally. Yeah. So where can we find you? Where can we find your work? Anything that you want to share, and I'll put it all in the show notes too, but share with where we can find you. All that.
Yeah. So my website just launched. You can find me at hoeonthego.net. The spelling of that is HEAUX, and the go is GEAUX because it's the
cool. Love it. Spelling. Yeah, love that. Love that.
trying to reclaim that word, you know, also just for safety because of the internet. You can also find me on Instagram at hoeonthego and Twitter, which is more of like my sex work kind of like looser info. And that's hogo for Twitter.
And is go spelled the same way?
Yes, it is spelled the same way for all of them.
Thank you so much, Sanaya. This was really informative and just really great perspective on with the work that you do and just sharing so openly about it. Cause I think just more people need to, like you said, just like needs to be normalized, needs to be discussed more, needs to be, this is part of our lives, you know, all of our lives. So really, really appreciate it.
No, thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast.
Yeah. I'm just going to stop the recording really quick.
A
As always, thank you for listening. You can find Naya on Instagram at hoeonthego, H-E-A-U-X, on the G-E-A-U-X, Twitter at hoego, and their website is hoeonthego.net. You can find me at PsycheInTheCityBK on Instagram. You can email me at PsycheInTheCityBK@gmail.com. And yeah, that's it. Okay, bye.